Good afternoon, everybody. We're glad you came today to hear our guest speaker, Andrew McAfee. He's not related to John McAfee, who's played around the similar field and maybe in jail or somewhere right now. Andy McAfee has gone between Harvard and MIT so many times. It's not a very long distance, but he's the only one I've ever known that does it by walking on the water. This is an interesting man. He has spent a great deal of time trying to figure out what happens to the world as this digital and computing technology reaches the point of singularity where it exceeds the capacity of the human brain as we know it today to go on. And he's going to talk that and related things. I wanted to say that I try to come up with something a little screwy about each of our speakers, and most of Andy's screwy, but the one I thought you might be interested in, and he's out looking for an octopus that he can own and bring into his house and make friends with. So I hope you didn't mind that. But anyway, with that, I'd like to introduce you to Andy, and here we go.
Dick, thanks very much. Dick actually asked me when we were talking about coming down here, tell me something interesting, tell me something a little offbeat about yourself that I would not find on the internet. And I was absolutely no help to him. I think of myself as a deeply uninteresting person. That didn't stop him for a second. If you know Dick, you probably know that wouldn't even slow him down. He actually went behind my back to my partner and asked her for something weird about me. And she came up with, which is a true story, one of my ambitions is to find an octopus aquarium that I can put in my house in Cambridge. I want to thank Dick and Shelley and the rest of the Forum Club for having me here. Anything that gets you out of New England in early March is just the best that you can imagine. And thank you all for coming out. I want to congratulate the students that we heard from earlier today. One of them just told me that she's applying to MIT. My goal for today has changed. I now want Oli not to dissuade her from attending the school with what I'm going to talk about here. So as Dick says, I essentially study technological progress and how it changes the business world, and then by extension, how it changes the world, how it changes society. My co-author, Eric Brynjolfsson, and I wrote a book a little while back called The Second Machine Age, and I don't want to give you a summary of the book today. In a sense, I want to tell you what we've learned since the book came out. It came out just about 2 years ago, and it's already terribly, sorely out of date. And I would feel bad about that, except that that seems to be the case with everything having to do with technology and technological progress these days. The pace of change is extraordinary. So what I want to do today is give you one fairly focused example of that extraordinary rate of change and the progress that we're seeing, and then talk a bit about the implications of that kind of progress. To do that, though, I want to start off by getting a little bit of context and showing you a quick slideshow of things that I'm actually not going to talk about. So you're going to see I'm not going to talk about robots and self-driving cars and some of the other things that you're about to see here. Each of these is a pretty amazing phenomenon, and you should have people down here to talk about all of them. I think they're all instances of the same broad phenomenon, which essentially is weirdly fast technological progress. We've had this strange experience since we wrote the book. We have gone around and gone back and talked to a lot of the people who we interviewed and who we learned from for the book, and we keep on hearing the same thing over and over from them, which is, wow, I wasn't expecting that to happen so quickly. We actually asked Elon Musk a little while back when Tesla was going to have completely self-driving cars, and he said, look, I have stopped trying to make that prediction because it used to be 20 years, and then it was 10, and now it's 5, and now it's yesterday, actually. So this phenomenon of technological progress that is so fast that it's taking by surprise even the people who are generating the innovations is really, really interesting. I want to give you my single favorite example of that kind of progress and then talk a little bit about the implications of it, and then let's throw it up and see what else we want to talk about. To do that, though, I need to start off by asking a question. Does anyone here play the Asian strategy game Go? How many of us have heard of this game? This is a great question to get the strategy nerds in an audience to identify themselves. Because it turns out the more you're into game theory and strategy and the bigger nerd you are, the more likely you are to be obsessed with this game. This is a thousands of years old Asian game. It's one of these things that's 5 seconds to explain and then a lifetime to answer. If I play to master, if I play white and you play black, every time I surround your stones, I take them off the board. Same thing you do for me. We take turns placing stones. That's all there is to it. Why is it such a big deal? Computers got better than human beings at playing chess in about 1997, when Garry Kasparov lost to IBM's Deep Blue in that famous match. The digital progress with computer chess has continued. It's not even close. The head-to-head contest between humans and computers is not even close in chess these days. It's so lopsided that they asked a human grandmaster a little while back how he would prepare for a match against a computer, and he said, "I'd bring a hammer." So computer chess has been, computer versus human chess has been uninteresting for 20 years. Computer versus human Go has remained fascinating for that whole time, essentially because the digital geeks, the computer geeks, couldn't even come close to writing a program that could beat even a moderately skilled human being. So this is a story that came out in Wired magazine just in the middle of 2014, talking about progress with digital Go and the head-to-head competitions that had happened up to that point between computers and people. They were incredibly lopsided the other way. Even mid-range Go players, and all the top Go players are out in East Asia. There's a smattering elsewhere around the world. There are probably a couple decent Go players back at MIT. But whenever a decent player would sit down against the top computer, it was not even close. The person would mop the floor with the computer. And it brings up a fairly deep question. Why? If we got better than human beings and all of humanity at a really difficult, very subtle game like chess 20 years ago, why is Go so different? And there are a couple parts, there are a couple reasons for the answer. One is that there are many more possible Go games than there are atoms in the universe. What that means is that if you try to simulate your way to an answer, one thing computers are really good at is performing lots of calculations very, very quickly. So you'd think, okay, just take the game where it stands now, simulate all the possible games going forward, and pick your best move based on that. It absolutely won't work. You won't even get close. You won't. If we wired together all the computers in the world and set them to work on one single Go game, they would not be able to simulate all the possible outcomes before the sun burned itself out. So brute force computing power is of remarkably little help in this quest to beat humans at the game of Go. So we can't do that. The other main technique, if you can't just do simulations and get your way to the answer, the other technique is to learn the smart rules, learn the smart strategies, and program them into a computer. So that's exactly what we did 20 years ago to beat Kasparov. We took advantage of lots of computing power, and it's pretty clear some of the rules of chess and the rules of chess are totally clear. The strategies for playing chess are also pretty clear. You know, don't generally sacrifice a queen for a pawn, and you go on like that, and you get these nice rules for playing the game of chess at a pretty high level. It turns out this doesn't work for the game of Go. And there's one particular reason it doesn't work, and it was really well summarized by Michael Polanyi, who was one of the great philosopher scientists of the 20th century, and he summarized what's going on here with one sentence. He said, "We know more than we can tell." And what he meant by that is if you go talk to any human who's performing at a pretty high level in their domain of expertise, and you ask them, "How are you doing this? What rules are you following? What are your heuristics? What are your strategies? How are you so good at what you're doing?" It doesn't matter. It could be a Go player. It could be a radiologist. It could be a race car driver. And let's say that that person honestly wanted to answer the question as completely and helpfully as possible. At some point, you would run aground because the person cannot articulate the rules that they themselves are using to do what they do, to perform at that level. We don't have very, it turns out we don't have very good access to our own knowledge in the domains where we're good. We fool ourselves. A lot of us walk around thinking we know how we do what we do. It turns out if you actually test that, we're wrong about ourselves. We have lousy intuition about our own intuition. So this is a really thorny problem. It's particularly tough in the game of Go for a couple reasons. One of them is if you show any person who knows anything about chess a board at any stage of the game, it's immediately obvious, especially if you've got more experience, it's immediately obvious who's winning that game, who has the stronger position on the board. If you do that with a game of Go, it's often really, really hard, even for experienced people, to say white is in the lead or black is in the lead. There are just too many possible outcomes, too much that can happen going forward. So we've got this terrible problem where we cannot use brute force computing power to get to a solution. We can't use the knowledge that the experts have because it turns out the experts can't even tell you why they're so expert. This is a great quote from a high-level Go player. He says, look, my brain is pretty good at this particular task. I've been studying it for decades. I've been playing and playing and playing. If you show me a board, I will know a good move. I don't know why it's a good move. I can't explain to you why this is the right thing to be doing. I just happen, it comes up from someplace deep inside me that I can't access and you can't access. Now, you would think this places a pretty hard ceiling on our ability to use computers to be good at Go. If brute force won't work, and if we can't program in the rules and the smart strategies because nobody on the planet can articulate them, then we're out of luck. Then humans are going to continue to be in the lead with the game of Go. This is what we thought as recently as just a couple months ago. There are a couple other implications here. One is if we turn our attention to the economy and to jobs and wages, this notion that we know more than we can tell has a pretty clear implication, which is that a lot of the work that human experts and human knowledge workers do is not going to be replaced by automation, is not going to be replaced by computers, simply because the people can't tell you what they're doing. They're like these high-level Go players. So this is a quote from David Autor, who's a colleague of mine back at MIT. For my money, the best labor economist studying these issues out there, he wrote a paper last year where he talked about this paradox, where we know more than we can tell. And he said, is it about to be overcome? And he said, look, when I look around and I look at the progress that I'm seeing with technology and I look at all the evidence, my answer is no, we're not at the point of getting past this paradox. In particular, with the game of Go, here's where we were as of December of 2015. An article this appeared in the Wall Street Journal in December of 2015. Again, why Go still foils the computer. So it's exactly the reasons that we just talked about. Brute force won't help you, and nobody on the planet can articulate the smart strategies for playing this game. That's where we were in December of 2015. Here's where we were in January of 2016. Done. This is another article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal summarizing the results of a paper that appeared in Nature magazine, one of the top journals in all of science, summarizing the results of a head-to-head competition between the top Go player in Europe and a new flavor of artificial intelligence. The human and this new system played 5 games against each other in the fall of last year. They kept the results secret, so nobody knew until January of this year. Played 5 games in fall of last year. The computer won 5-0. Something pretty profound changed. And this paper explains what changed and what this team did to overcome these apparently insurmountable disadvantages of technology in the face of human expertise. And I want to point out a couple things, first of all. This paper has about 20 authors on it. And if you look at them, this is like the roll call of the United Nations. This is an all-star team of digital geek talent from around the world. This is a company headquartered in London that got bought by Google in late 2014, exactly for their expertise in these domains of artificial intelligence and machine learning. What this team does is build systems that can learn rules on their own. So their approach here was fascinating. What they essentially did was about three things simultaneously to help this system get so good at playing Go. The first thing they did was show it hundreds and thousands of examples of games of Go played between top-level players. This game has been played for over 2,000 years. There are extensive records about high-level Go games between these ancient masters hundreds of years back. They recorded every move. There's a big library of Go games, in other words. What they essentially did was show all these games to the system and say, you figure out the smart strategies. Here's a bunch of examples. We know who won. We know what the outcome was. You figure out the rules for yourself. In much the same way, in a parallel way to the way that we would do it if we sat around and studied hundreds of years worth of games. This system can study many more than we can. It's got that capacity. So the system sat around and kind of looked at the outcomes and thought for a while and said, okay, I think I understand the rules here. The second thing they did was to say to the system, can you figure out who's got the stronger position at any point in time? Can you just pattern match and figure out who's got the stronger position? Turns out the system can actually do that as well. Then the third thing they said was, let's apply some of that brute force computing power. We don't want to simulate all the games. We will never, ever be able to do that in the time that we have. But given everything that we know about smart strategies and pattern matching and whatnot, here's a little subset of the possible outcomes. Let's go simulate those and figure out what the right move is from that. So with that combination of very, very smart brute force computing and hundreds of years worth of pattern matching put into digital form and internalized by this machine learning system, this team was able to beat the European Go champion 5-0. Now, they're going to play, I believe, the world's top Go player later this month. Here's a pro tip, bet on the technology. There's a lot of chatter going around these days saying, okay, but the top European player is not nearly as good as the top world player. This is not that impressive. I have a pretty strong view on this. I think the technology is going to dominate. If that doesn't happen in March of 2016, it'll happen by October of 2016. It'll happen by January of 2017. The reason I'm focusing on this example is because it was so unexpected, and the computer science community had been beating its head against this particular task, this task of playing Go at a high level, had been beating its head against that complexity for half a century, making very little progress. And then just like we saw, in the past year, in the past few months, that progress went from unimpressive to superhuman. That is a microcosm of what we're seeing in lots of different domains, especially domains that involve stuff that we like to think that we're fairly good at. We human beings are extraordinarily good pattern matchers. We are extraordinarily good at many different modes of communication. We used to think that was the high ground. I'm a lot less convinced that that is still the high ground when I see enough examples like this going on. I want to talk about a couple different implications of this, to my eyes, this astonishing and pretty unexpected surge in technological progress. And it's a good classic good news, bad news story. I want to lead with the good news, even though it's probably a bad presentation technique to wind up on the down note. Let me lead with the good news. I think this is, we are very lucky to be here at, as far as I can tell from looking at the evidence, is a deeply, deeply important turning point. And the turning point has actually, I believe, already taken place. The kinds of advances that I'm talking about here with Go and pattern matching and communication and all these other fields, what I think they're going to do is accelerate a trend that's already underway. And it's profoundly important, a profoundly beneficial trend. I think it's very underappreciated, so I want to highlight it here. I haven't come up with a better name for it than dematerialization. And what people mean by that is we are increasingly substituting bits, information, and code, different kinds of digital intelligence, for good old-fashioned atoms out there in the physical world. There's a swap going on. We're using more bits and fewer atoms in place after place. To make that idea concrete, I want to show you some evidence. I want to show you a graph that still blows me away every time I look at it. And maybe I'm a little bit strange in that I love to look at graphs about resource use over time, over 100 years in the United States. But bear with me, because I do think this is pretty fascinating. This is a graph of how much we use year by year of some pretty important physical building blocks in the American economy. In other words, how much steel do we use every year? How much copper? How much aluminum? How much phosphate? And how much potash for fertilizer for agriculture? Just important things that you stick into an economy to generate goods and services. And you see something really unsurprising, which is that as our country grew, as our economy grew, in general, we used more and more of these things. You see divots during recessions and depressions. You see a little bit of variation. But this is the unsurprising part. We use more and more of these atoms over time as our country grows, as our economy grows. Here's what's been happening since the turn of the century. We are using fewer of these things, of these physical building blocks of an economy, year by year. The American economy is about 30% bigger in real terms today than it was at the turn of the century, and yet we are using, in absolute terms, less aluminum, less copper, less iron, less steel, less like most of the physical building blocks in an economy, we are using less of. Another way to say this is that year by year, we are learning to tread more lightly on the planet. We're using fewer and fewer resources. I think this is a wonderful trend. It applies to agricultural land. It applies to water used for agriculture. It applies to tons and tons of different things that we do, not just in the United States, but increasingly around the world. We are giving land back to nature, and we're using fewer and fewer physical resources as our digital capabilities increase. So this is profoundly good news. I want to give the somewhat less cheery story about one of the side effects of this phenomenon, because one of the inputs, one of the physical inputs to an economy is, you know, us, essentially, is good old-fashioned human labor. And there's some evidence that as the digital stuff gets better and better and better, we need less and less of that labor in some ways. So to show you that, let me draw one more graph for you. This is a graph of, here's how much U.S. companies have been investing in software, you know, for ever since we had software, ever since about 1960 going forward. And you see that with a couple little blips, our thirst for software so far has been bottomless. We love this stuff. We keep on investing more and more in it. Let me superimpose on that a graph of what U.S. corporate profits as a percent of total GDP, as a percent of the total economy look like. That line's a lot more jagged, but you see a pretty healthy trend up there toward the end. For the post-war period, U.S. corporate profits have never been higher. Look at that nasty divot that they took during the Great Recession. I think a lot of us probably remember that period not very fondly. Look how quickly they bounced back from it. And corporate profits are at or near an all-time high in the post-war history. As we've been investing in software, that's been showing up in how efficient, how well-run our companies are. That's fantastic. This is all great news. I want to draw one more line on this graph. And instead of profits as a percent of total GDP, I want to show you how much of total GDP is getting paid out in wages to all American workers year after year. And you'll notice that that line actually has a very, very different trajectory. And you see the profit and the wage line, we're kind of doing a dance back and forth for most of the 20th century. And look how strongly those two have diverged since the turn of the century. The profits have been going in a really healthy direction. The total wages paid out have been going in the opposite direction. They are now at an all-time, as far as we can tell, an all-time post-war low. If you look at some of the other data about the hollowing out of the middle class, the polarization of the economy, the growth in fairly lousy, fairly low-paid jobs in America, you see the same phenomenon show up over and over. So you're going to work very hard to find a bigger optimist about technological progress than I am, because of the example of Go and lots of other things that we could talk about. It is letting us tread more lightly on our world, make better use of resources, be better stewards of our planet. This is all astonishingly good news. We need, I think, to have a mind out for the fact that we are needing some kinds of input, some kinds of physical input, human input, labor input, less and less over time. As the technology continues to race ahead and do these astonishing things, I don't expect that phenomenon to reverse itself. And what we do about that, I think, is going to be the great policy challenge and the great societal challenge for the next generation, at least in this country. If we get this wrong, think about this for a minute. What I'm talking about is a world of much greater abundance and much greater productivity. If we can't figure out how to make that a happy world for people to live in, shame on us, right? Let me stop there. I would love to hear, Dick, any questions or comments. Actually, let me say one more thing about this. Given if you believe this story at all, what are some of the smart things to do? There are a number of bad ideas floating around out there. A couple bad ideas, smash all the robots, is a deeply terrible idea. There's another idea that I hear increasingly from people who I think should know better, which is essentially Facebook and Google should be paying all the users for the data that they give them. Well, no, what Facebook and Google and these other great tech companies give are astonishingly powerful products and goods and services to people for free in exchange for their attention and their eyeballs so they can serve ads against them. There's nothing nefarious about that. There's really nothing new under the sun about that. But I hear over and over there's some kind of evil bargain being struck with the great tech companies. I think what's going on is absolutely the deal of the century with these tech companies. So I push back fairly hard against this idea that there's something nefarious going on. So those are the bad ideas. The much better ideas have to do with, why don't we stop turning out the kinds of workers that we needed half a century ago with our educational system and start trying to turn out the kinds of workers who can work with technology, have skills that are still in short supply, even in an age of brilliant technologies. And then finally, we do need to rethink both what we tax, how much we tax, and what we do with people who are trying to make a living from their labor. The single thing that I'm most in favor of is a big expansion of, it's called the earned income tax credit right now. A way to think about that is it's just a negative income tax. If people are out there trying to play by the rules and work and contribute to the economy, but the market wage is not really great, fantastic. Let's top that up. Let's continue to reward that kind of effort and that attempt to play by the rules that we've established. The robots, even though they're really amazing, are not going to take all of our jobs tomorrow or next year. So let's try to keep our labor force engaged and involved and heading in a healthy direction. Okay, now, let me stop. I would love to hear what kinds of questions people have in the wake of that. Thank you.
Andy, thank you. It's nice to know that we're no longer smarter than anything else. But before we get started with these questions, I would like to give you a small symbol for you to lug back in your backpack of our thanks for you. And these are books on Marco Island, which is also a part of our affiliation. Yep. and Naples. And you don't have to hold them. We'll take care of them.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Now, don't leave until the last question because it will say something to you. My first question is from a student. There is a powerful statement, quote, to engineer is human.
Mm-hmm.
We humans are engineering new technology that is surpassing human capacity. That's what you said. Do you think by continuing to advance technology, we're following human instinct or reaching toward something we do not know? And if so, is this a good thing?
Yeah.
You have an hour.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the singularity question, which comes up every time you talk about these kinds of developments. And it's a really logical question because we're talking about these exponential improvements, unexpected, exponential, consequential, big deal improvements, where our human capabilities, as Dick said, are getting surpassed in domain after domain by digital stuff. The logical question is, how much longer is that going to go on? Does anything remain safe? Are we still kind of better at anything than the technologies after that's been going on for a while? And what are the consequences of that? As people have talked about this far future of incredibly powerful technologies, there's a utopian version about what's going on and a dystopian version about what's going on. The utopian version usually goes by the label of the singularity. Folk like Ray Kurzweil have been talking about it for a while, and they've got this kind of happy vision where once the computers get powerful enough and they've attained kind of complete consciousness, our intelligence merges with their intelligence, and we kind of drift up into the cloud and become immortal in some real sense of the word and just live this disembodied life where our will and our consciousness and our soul and whatever else are just kind of like at least partly digital. Ray Kurzweil believes this deeply enough that he has radically changed his diet and his lifestyle in the hope of living long enough to see this happen so that his brain can be one of the ones that gets kind of merged into the cloud. That's the happy version. The unhappy version usually goes with a different label. It's called superintelligence, and it usually means something bad. It means that after the technology continues to outstrip us in domain after domain, it can at some point do everything that we do better than we do it. And then at some point, the fear goes, that digital technology looks over at us and says, what do I need you for? And then we wind up in some kind of Terminator or some Matrix future where we're waging war against the machines. And since they're better at everything than us, we don't win that war. And that's the end of humanity as we know it. So this, both the happy and the unhappy versions of this question are really active these days. And some very smart people like Elon Musk and Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking have been warning us about the dangers of progress with artificial intelligence. I think that is absolutely irresponsible fear-mongering. Because even though I'm telling stories about this strange rapid progress in domains that used to belong to us, when I go talk to the people who are generating these technologies, who are building these things for a living, and I ask them, hey, are we headed for some future where the computers are better at everything than we are? I hear the same thing back over and over. And what I hear back is essentially, there is nothing on our current research trajectory that should lead anyone to be worried about that kind of outcome. We are not engineering any kind of general intelligence or consciousness or soul. We are building systems that can solve specific problems in specific domains, like playing the game of Go. There's just nothing that's going to lead to a full digital brain. What I hear over and over is, we really have no idea how the brain works. It is still a deep mystery. We don't understand intelligence. We don't understand consciousness. We do not understand these things. So to think that we can replicate them with technology is a bit of a joke. The single best way that I ever heard to think about this comes from a guy who does artificial intelligence research for a living. He said, worrying about superintelligence and this scary future of AI is like worrying about overpopulation on Mars. So that calms me down a lot.
Thank you. You already answered the next question. I'm going to read it because I wanted you to know that a student came up with this one. And it says, in what ways do you consider this technology to be underappreciated? I think you more or less just covered that.
Yeah, I think two things are underappreciated. I think the pace of change remains underappreciated. I still underappreciate it, and this is what I'm supposed to do for a living. And then the economic, the environmental, the planetary consequences, I think, are very much underappreciated. So that's probably going to be the next book.
Can't wait. Now, we're going to ask you to solve some of our problems today. All right?
We'll try.
Obama has just called me about this. What is your view on Apple versus the government?
And I see we're just about out of time. Thank you all for coming. that is such a great question because there are two absolutely legitimate and incompatible points of view on that one. One is we need to be able to track what the bad guys are doing, and we need to be able to count on the technology community to help us with that. The other one is we need to be able to roll out products for people that absolutely have world-class privacy and security and give people the assurance that they can have their privacy and security maintained. I am not trying to dodge the question. I don't know where I come down on that one. I do have some sympathy for Apple's argument that this is not a one-time thing, and if we do it this time, we know for sure you're going to come back to us with more and deeper and more invasive, and why don't you just hand us the keys kind of a thing. So that said, I am firmly on the side of the technology industry that building in back doors and thinking you're only going to hand the keys to the government does not work. That genie is not going to stay in that bottle. That I believe.
We've just learned that Andy is not a computer.
Did I give a non-computer answer to that question?
Well, it took a different dimension of thinking. We'll get there in a minute. Now, can computer technologies help decide international relations strategies?
They can be of a lot of help. No, but yes, I think is my answer to that question. The yes part is a little bit easier to answer. It turns out that it is remarkably easy to beat the predictions, the forecasts, the judgments of even incredibly seasoned intelligence analysts and political scientists. If you ask them about any development on the planet, what's going to happen more than about a year or two out, you might as well get a monkey to throw a dart at a dartboard. They are no better than, even though they will say with great confidence, here's how the Middle East is going to play out, stop listening. Those long-range forecasts have no value whatsoever. Shorter term, it is remarkable how easy it is to beat the assessments of very, very experienced, very well-trained, very intelligent people with a band of outsiders, basically, some fairly geeky folk who are much more rigorous, much more data-driven, much more willing to question their own experience and their own expertise. They use a little bit of technology to help them with that. The intelligence community research arm just announced yesterday or today another round of contests to figure out how to use more tools and more technologies to get even better at that kind of work of predicting what's going to happen around the globe. So stay tuned for that. It's really important work. So the geeks can absolutely help us improve our crystal ball for what's going to happen around the world, because our crystal ball is really bad, way too bad, worse than it needs to be. What they shouldn't help us with is what do we want to have happen around the world? That's a question about our priorities. It's a question about our values. I would never outsource those to a piece of technology any more than I would outsource my vote to a piece of technology.
Good timing.
Ah, here we go.
Can technology, your computers, foretell the Republican nominee for the President of the United States.
See, you talk about one instance where the pundits and the prognosticators, including the geeks, including the data-driven ones, were saying things with a great deal of confidence about what was or wasn't going to happen. Think how deadly wrong they have been. So the real world, I think the conclusion is that the real world can throw very serious curveballs at you, even after you think you've got a lot of experience and even after you've crunched a lot of numbers. But, you know, this is what baseball managers say. That's why we play the game, is because the outcomes are a little bit unknown.
Well done. All right. A tougher one here.
All right.
Will the world that you envision benefit the poor, the poorly educated, and inner-city youth? You touched on that, and it wasn't promising, but what do you think?
It really depends on if you're asking a question about America or another country in the rich world, or if you're asking a question about the world.
The world.
Because it turns out that I think the most heartening development around the world of the past 20 years has been the huge reduction in dire, dire poverty. The number of people living on less than $2 a day has gone down by at least half in the past generation. After being really stubborn for a long, long time, it's fallen off a cliff. And there are a couple different reasons for that. China becoming a little bit less communist is a huge, huge part of that story. But the spread of technology around the world is another part of that story. So globally, the most vulnerable, the poorest among us around the world have never seen their fortunes improve so much. Now, that work is not over. There's a lot more to do. But that's the really great news. If we think a little bit more parochially about the United States, it's not that things are getting terribly worse for the folk at the bottom. It's that they're not getting any better. It's that the poverty is dire, it seems entrenched, a lack of social mobility in the country that considers itself the land of opportunity. The more we learn about social mobility in America, the more we need to stop saying that, because it's absolutely not true. A lot of us in this room are wonderful exceptions to that trend. The trend is that you stay where you're born. And figuring out how to get around that, again, is a big part of our homework. I have some optimism that technology can help, but what I don't believe is that even these wonderful techs are just magic fairy dust that we're going to sprinkle on the economy and everything's going to get better for everybody. I wish that were the case.
Okay. Now, I think I have time for just two more. Another very practical question, especially for me, but asked by somebody out here. Any comment on Bitcoin?
So, how many of us have heard of this thing called Bitcoin? Did you ever talk about this? This is a well-informed audience. How many of us feel like we understand what the hell it is? Yeah. Many fewer hands go up. Bitcoin is this completely artificial currency that the geeks dreamed up. Okay, fine. You and I could dream up a currency. It wouldn't go anywhere. What's really interesting about Bitcoin is that it's based on this thingy called a blockchain. And the way to think about the blockchain is that it's a ledger of transactions that have happened among people who own bitcoins. Okay, great. You know, every bank needs a ledger. What's really interesting about this particular ledger is that it is distributed around the internet. It is the responsibility of nobody. It is completely decentralized and uncontrolled. There is no way for it to become centralized and to come under any authority like a bank, like a government, like whatever. They simply couldn't command this thing if they wanted to. And it appears to be hacker-proof. This is remarkable, right? This came out of nowhere. The other deeply weird thing about it, we don't know who came up with it. The inventor, the main programmer of this thing, is a guy only known by a pseudonym. This is a deeply, deeply weird development. What that means, though, is that we have the opportunity to set up an alternative to our existing ledgers and our financial systems and our transactions and our wealth transfers and all these things where this transaction happened, if the internet says it did. Not if your bank says it did, not if your government says it did, not if the courts agree that it did. Nothing. We can actually make things happen. We can do wills and escrows and contracts and money transfers and things like that. It's very, very cheap. It seems to be fairly bulletproof. And it happens if the internet kind of agrees that it did, with no other criteria, no authority whatsoever. What are we going to do with this? Nobody knows. Well, but I will tell you that my investor friends, my biggest geek friends in Silicon Valley, are on fire excited about this and are investing really heavily.
So this is a very interesting problem because our government doesn't even know who to go after.
That's the point. And they think, well, okay, who do I go to shut it down? You do not shut it down. Weird.
There you go. All right. Yeah. Now, your final question. We see that Tesla and Google and heaven knows who else are coming out with automated automobiles. And I have little doubt that they will be smarter and more reactive than most people. Not you, but maybe me. Now, here's the situation. Your car is driving along the highway, and a Mack truck weighing tons and tons cuts right across the center line, and it is going to hit you head on, period. What will the programs decide about who you kill? Yourself by going straight forward, or all those children on the sidewalk by turning right?
So how many of us have heard of trolley problems? A couple of us. This is an example of what's called a trolley problem. And this was a category of mental exercise invented by, I forget who, a few decades ago, which had to do with if there's a trolley heading toward a person who's unconscious on the tracks, would you pull a switch to send that trolley off to the side? Yeah, everybody would pull that switch, right? Of course I'd do that. Would you pull that switch if there were two people tied up over on the side track? Well, no, I probably wouldn't do that. Instead of pulling the switch, would you push your buddy off the overpass so that his body would fall in front of the trolley and therefore that other person would be saved? Well, no, I wouldn't. What if there were five people unconscious on the tracks and you pushed one buddy? Would you do that? And most people would still say, absolutely not. I would not physically push that guy to save five people. So there's this whole category of problems called trolley problems that came up about these moral or ethical dilemmas about what actions would you take in the face of doing this kind of harm versus that kind of harm. We learn, the main thing we learn from people actually doing these experiments and responding to trolley problems, we are massively irrational about what to do. So this example of I would not push you even to save five people, it turns out I wouldn't push you to save 10. I wouldn't push you to save 100. I wouldn't push you to save that entire village of people over there. And as far as we can tell, it's because this act of pushing you just feels so icky to me that I'd rather not do that than save a whole city worth of people over there. So a consequence of that, we are terribly irrational about these kinds of moral dilemmas. What that means is that in the moment that you've just described, in the spur of the moment situation where truck, kids, me, whatever, we're going to make the wrong choice over and over and over. I think the right choice is to say, to make a utilitarian calculation and say what's going to lead to the greatest, the smallest loss of life. Our cars, our automatic cars, will be much better at that calculation than we are. We should give the decision to them.
Okay, final question. We're almost there.
I think I made a lot of friends with that one, didn't I? No.
You alluded to this before, mm-hmm. And that is, will computers ever develop a soul?
No. Short answer. I don't believe so. We don't know what a soul is. We have no idea where it springs from. The workings of our minds are still so opaque to us. We can fake it very convincingly. We can fake emotions. We're building emotionally responsive robots. We can do all that. But this ineffable thing inside of us, whatever it is, I would use a different label for it, but I have zero worry that that's going to become surpassed by some digital equivalent of it.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dick.
Well, thank you all. Wonderful.